Welcome to TJ Frog's podcast, where I chat about my knitting, Dorset buttons and creativity in general, as well as sharing my love of Scotland, especially the Highlands and Islands. Hello, I'm Tanya, aka TJ Frog, or sometimes called the Button Lady, and in my creative business I predominantly make and promote the traditional craft of Dorset buttons, which dates back to the early 1600s, a cottage industry that employed many people in Dorset on the south coast of England. Brought up in Dorset, I now live on the Isle of Skye, and wherever you may be in the world, welcome and thank you for joining me for my 44th episode, Different and Preferred. For me, May has slipped by and we pop into June as I record this. Last episode was all about challenges, and in some ways this episode is a slight extension or twist on that, as I draw together a few experiences which highlighted to me different or preferred ways of doing things or what we like. I've got lots to catch up on and chat about. I'm not quite sure how long this episode is going to be. I think it could turn into a bumper episode. If you're sat at home, settle down with your latest craft project. Or if you're out with a dog, I hope you've planned a long walk. Or maybe you'll listen to this over two or three walks. And if you want to get through an enormous ironing pile, you're cleaning or cooking, then hopefully I can while away the time with you. For this episode then, the weather, a mixed bag at times, albeit overall very calm and great for the growing season. Creativity, project updates, and reinforcing some of the different tools and techniques and preferences that I have. Dorset buttons and wider news from the TJ Frog pad. Workshops, festivals, technical stuff and inspiration. Skye Focus, the final part in a three-part series, Getting to Skye. The weather. This year the lambing snow stayed away, hooray. And although we've had a mixed bag of weather, it's been interspersed with some amazing calm, still and at times quite summery days. I still pinch myself that we live where we do, and I can have the window open on a calm day and hear the lapping of the sea, the birds, the sheep, the cattle, and of course the cuckoo, which was very vocal this year. It's always a point of conversation as to when and where you first heard the cuckoo, and I hadn't realised until quite recently how many superstitions are associated with this. We heard an owl one night, which is very rare here. Such a lovely sound. I love hearing an owl. I find there's something quite haunting about it. For me, it's that signal that night has fallen. We used to hear them frequently when we lived on the south coast of England. I'm not sure what type of owl this one was because I don't know enough about different owl calls. And as so often occurs with sound, it was hard to tell the direction it was coming from, although it certainly sounded close by. I realise I'm not particularly clued up on bird sounds at all to be able to differentiate many different calls. That's something I would like to learn more about. I did see an owl here a few years ago. We were coming back late one night when we disturbed it on the single track road where there were some trees and shrubs, and it was too dark and too quick in flight for us to have a chance of identifying what type it was. We've got a little book, it's called Skye Birds, and I found out that there's also a website done by the same people who've done the book, and on there people can log sightings of different types of birds. So I'm going to be dipping into this a bit more often to try and identify some of the species that I see that are unfamiliar to me. The swallows are back, although we've begun to notice that there are far fewer than we've seen in recent years. We're going to wait and see how many numbers gather when they begin their migration. We still have a pair nesting in our byre, and we've had a few nests on our land again this year. Thrush, chaffinch, wagtail, blackbird and starling fledglings are now all out and about, and they're exploring and pecking away at the stones and the grass. We try not to disturb them, and we're conscious to minimise our trips in and out of the byres. Once though, when I was in there getting some stuff, I could hear this chirping and I was looking all around everywhere trying to see where it was coming from. And it literally was right above my head on one of the wooden struts. It wasn't a nest that I'd actually seen before. The buzzards are also out to hunting. And my TJ Frog staff hubby reliably informs me the sea eagles are too, but I've not actually seen them myself. I first noticed gulls here during COVID. I think they were travelling a bit further afield for food scraps, as there was no longer the people at the beach resorts with their picnics and chips. Growing up, I've always called gulls seagulls, which I know in theory isn't correct. There are a variety of gulls, and some live by the sea and some don't. Learning different gull recognition is something for me to explore, to understand exactly which gulls we have in our corner of sky. For me, seagulls, as I'm going to call them at the moment, they transform me to the seaside. Now, I know I live by the sea, but I don't, in my eyes, live at the seaside in the sense of a beach, a promenade, ice cream shop, fish and chip shop. Hopefully you get my drift. I was brought up by the seaside, so that's what I associate seagulls with. Flocks of them diving in to scavenge food discarded by humans. And if you're very unlucky, they may even swoop in and take your sandwich or chips out of your hand, which I've seen done many a time. To have them here now all the time feels odd, especially as I say, up until COVID, I never saw them. I wasn't aware of them. Maybe they were here and I just hadn't twigged. But I think that they're pretty vocal that I would have known that they were here. In the past few weeks, we've had four of them regularly circling around. And I'm possibly wondering, is it because of the nesting birds and that they were after the eggs? There's just something about the sound of the seagull, which to me just feels intrusive. Whereas the sounds of the small birds is more coral-like. I should say, when I'm talking about all these birds around our property, we don't have any bird food out. They are purely feeding off the land, whether that be seeds or berries, insects, worms, grubs, and for the bigger birds, the voles and the field mice that are around. We leave certain parts of our garden wild, and there are lots of stones too, which gives them plenty of areas for them to rummage around in for food. And we're fortunate enough to be able to watch them from the house. These last few weeks is a time of year when we see a quick change through the flora, and each year is different, with one type of flower seeming dominant or in greater abundance than the previous year. In 2024, we have been struck by the immense vibrancy and sheer volume of flora, really quite different to previous years since we've been here. The rich golden yellow gorse put on a fabulous display. Going over the Sky Bridge and heading onto the mainland just past Kyle of Loch Ausch are two of many areas around us which put on a great gorse display this year. The bluebells were out in swathes across some of the fields, along the road edges, their lovely purpley blue heads wafting in the breeze. And in fact, it's the most bluebells I have ever seen in my time on Sky. I've recently been away for 12 days, and when I returned home, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe the change in the local landscape growth. No longer were the sides of the roads having green shoots coming up through the winter debris. They were fully sprung green everywhere. The gorse was receding, the bluebells were wilting, fading to grey, only to be replaced by masses and masses of great patches of rich, vibrant pink and purple rhododendrons. Again, I have never seen them so much on Sky and the mainland as this year. It's quite spectacular. And what is fantastic, we get to see it all for free. I saw my first foxglove last week on a stroll along my road, and a couple of days ago, we saw huge clusters of the yellow flag iris. Again, never have I seen so many in our corner of Sky. It really does feel like a spectacular year for the floral displays. We've got some old tyres and wooden planters that have spent far too long in our garden empty. Finally, we bought some plants. in the hope that we might be able to grow something. And at the wind and the salt and, of course, the deer won't cause too much damage. I thought heathers would be a pretty good bet after all the hillsides are covered in it. I also got some lavender, alpines and sedums. And the cows and the calves in the field next door were very closely watching me as I planted them. So far, the deer haven't eaten any, although they have trampled about in a couple of the planters. I also had to water them as well, as the weather was so good for a few days. Not something I thought I'd need to do here on Skye. Fingers crossed that they will take and grow. As I say, everything in the wild is growing amazingly, so let's hope that that transforms into what I've put in my planters and tyres. In the meantime, we are fighting the dock leaves, which we've got a lot of, and they are very tall. From time to time, we have a neighbouring crofter who puts sheep in our field. We've recently had some soil delivered to this field from the crofter, who's landscaping a patch of their land for a couple of holiday cabins. And the sheep love it, and they have provided me with much amusement. I love sitting, eating dinner, and just watching these sheep and this soil pile. It's so funny. They sit on it, they stand on it, they rummage around in it, they snuggle down into it, they push each other off it. Yeah. What is it about this that they prefer to the grass? I'm wondering if it traps the warmth of the sun better than the grass. I'm not sure. If anyone knows, please do get in touch and let me know. You may well know, or you may have seen it yourself. On the 10th of May, we were treated to the most incredible northern lights. A time of year we wouldn't usually be looking out for them, as October to March is mainly the prime time. Fortunately, early in the evening, I had seen a Facebook post from Glendale Skye Auroras that strong CMEs, or coronal mass ejections, oh, that's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? Emitted from the sun were due to collide with the Earth, with the potential for the strongest aurora in decades. Their intensity resulted in extreme geomagnetic storms with amazing auroras, which could be seen in many parts of the UK and around the world in both northern and southern hemispheres. According to the NASA website, it was the most powerful to affect the Earth for many years, reaching G5, which is the highest level on the geomagnetic storm scale. And it seems that there may be many more great auroras in 2024, as the sun is likely to be most active in its 11-year solar cycle. On the NASA website, you can find an article which is called How NASA Tracked the Most Intense Solar Storm in Decades. And Teresa Neves Chinchilla, the acting director of NASA's Moon to Mars Space Weather Analysis Office, said, "We'll be studying this event for years. It will help us test the limits of our models and understanding of solar storms." That evening, I kept a watch on updates and I saw a post to look due south, which of course felt a bit counterintuitive, as Northern Lights, well, the name kind of gives it away. They're in the north. It would seem that the sheer nature of the solar flares, the arc, the corona, extended the reach of where you'd normally look. And for us, south and east were best. I do not fully understand the whole science of it. It's something I would like to learn a lot more because of what happened and what I saw that particular night. It was 11:30 when I looked through my phone and saw these amazing pinks and greens. The photographer in the house, TJ Frogstaff, my hubby, was unwell and asleep. And I was so excited by my photo I took, I woke him up to have a look at his. Oh dear, yeah. He did acknowledge it and promptly fell back asleep very quickly, which showed how unwell he was at the time, because he was not going to get out of bed to look at it. I was mesmerised by it though, and I stayed up till about 1 o'clock in the morning, slowly watching the light change. Eventually it became visible to the naked eye, and there was this light, these shards of white, almost wispy cloud coming from a central point in the sky and radiating out and down. And the more I watched it, the more the colours started to show themselves to me as my eyes adjusted to the night light. I felt like I was beneath an umbrella of stunning light that was moving around me. It really was quite incredible. Of course, the phone captures the light and intensity of the colour to a greater degree, making it likely that photos will always look more colourful than what the naked eye sees. This night, here in our corner of sky, was truly special, a display like I've never seen before. I've popped a couple of photos in my show notes, and I'm hoping that the prediction of more auroras in 2024 comes true. The Haar, or sea mist, is making sky live up to its name of the Misty Isle at the moment. It's visited quite a few times over the last few weeks, often bringing to land the fine rain that is great for gradually soaking into the ground. It sometimes makes the landscape feel quite eerie as the cloud kisses the top of the hills and mountains and then slowly wafts down the sides to the sea, swallowing up the horizon. One minute we can see the sea, the horizon, the coastline, the hills. The next it completely disappears and the windows are wet. Then it withdraws again and comes back again and so forth in waves. I love watching it as the light and the dark shades of the clouds evolve, sometimes bringing quite a bright, dazzling light. Other times it can be dark and sinister and eerie, making it almost feel like nighttime is falling. And then there's the changing colours of the sea, from a light grey to a real milkiness and an inky blue. Some days it stayed all day, and then suddenly in the evening, the setting sun has burst through and cleared, leaving these brilliant blue skies. Really quite contrasting days at the moment. Not quite sure it feels like summer. As I mentioned at the beginning then, quite a mixed bag of weather going on currently. Sunrise is now around 4:35 and sunset 10 past 10. Somehow June has crept up on me and we're not that far off summer solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, and I can't quite believe we're already about to reach this milestone in the year. Creativity. You may have seen on social media the Ernest Nettle vest, which I test knitted for Scottish knitwear designer Maddie Harvey, launched on Friday the 17th of May. It's a great layering top for putting over a shirt or a long sleeve t-shirt. Maddie released another pattern on the same day, the Nebula Nova sweater, which uses the same broken rib as the vest with contrast patterned stitches across the main stocking stitch body. It's a lovely top and another I've added to my very long list of sweaters I'd love to knit one day. There's a photo in the show notes of me wearing my Ernest Nettle vest. Do you prefer knitting or wearing sweaters or vests? I tend to wear more sweaters, although I love vests and I plan to add more to my wardrobe. I have one I knitted a long time ago. Off the top of my head, I think I used Rowan Kid Silk Aura, which is a slightly heavier weight than the Kid Silk Haze. I might be wrong, but that's what I'm thinking. I haven't worn it for a long time, and to be honest, it's mainly because my knitting skills were not so great when I made this. And it's all rib, and you can see the really baggy stitch going up the side of the rib where I've switched between knit and purl. One day I'll pull the stitches through to make them look a bit more even, because it just bugs me. I also have my cashmere Entrelac vest from the Tribe Knit Along, which I'm still steadily working my way through. I've got two vests on my knit to-do list. One is the Slipover by Wilma Malcolmson, which appears in the Shetland Wool Week 2019 annual. And the second one, which I'm about to embark on, is a pattern from the Knitting Tales website. Nora Howley set up Knitting Tales, focusing on rediscovering and promoting lost or forgotten knitting and crochet patterns. At the heart of these are some amazing historical Shetland-themed patterns by Ron Schweitzer using Shetland wool. The one I'm doing is from the Seasons collection called Autumn, and I'm making it in natural colours. I will be revealing more about this over the next few months. In the meantime, if you'd like to take a peek, there's a link in the show notes to Nora's website. The Debbie Abrahams Mystery Blanket 2017 is finally finished. Yay! And I love it. At least I have my fingers crossed that it's finally finished and I'm not going to find some more Swiss darning that needs doing or a button that needs adding. You see, it had been hanging over the back of my office chair for a few days after having spent hours and hours and more hours sewing in all those ends. And one day I realised that I hadn't yet taken a photo of it for podcast show notes. As I prepared to do this, an unexpected thought fluttered through my mind. Had I really finished it? Mainly because after so long, I couldn't quite believe it was done. And guess what? I hadn't. The flowers on the square with the sheep are sewn on afterwards in a lazy daisy embroidery stitch, and they each have a bead added in the centre. The bead was missing. And there's four squares and four flowers on each square, so 16 beads in total to add, which is not a huge amount of work. If I'd have added the bead, though, as I was making the flower, it would have been simpler and quicker because I could have sewn them in at the end after making the flower and used that yarn. There were four different coloured flowers, which meant a new piece of yarn for each bead, each flower. I was nearly ready to record, having resigned myself to telling you it would have to wait for another day. Then I gave myself a good talking to, seized the moment and just did it. Yes, it's done. The blanket's on the bed, the photo's taken, and as I said, I absolutely love it to bits. The colours, the purples, the pinks and the greens are really giving it a vibrant spring summery vibe. With all the 68 flags around the border, it feels a very substantial blanket and it makes a great statement on the bed. I can see me taking this off the bed and putting it over my knees in my office during colder days in the winter. Do look at it in the show notes. Debbie Abrahams is an amazing designer. And when you go on an adventure of these mystery blankets with her, you can't always see at the start where it's going to go and how it's all going to come together, but it does. I did change a couple of things, which Debbie's always happy for people to do, although I've never done it before. For this blanket, I didn't want to do the Fair Isle squares. Two reasons. One, I try and avoid doing flat Fair Isle these days if I can help it, so I don't have to purl it. And secondly, because the blanket was inspired by and also used designs from some of the previous blankets, with it being a kind of celebration of the blankets to date, I'd already done those Fair Isle squares in another blanket. Instead, I replaced it with the corresponding squares from what's called the option 2 that Debbie always gives, which is usually textured stitches and stripes for people who don't want to do Fair Isle and intarsia. I also loved the sheep so much that I replaced the other intarsia pictures all with sheep. I dared to be different, and I'm very happy with the result. Talking of beads and having just been on a Debbie Abrahams workshop, we did a beaded case and I thought I'd talk about different ways of adding beads to knitting and indeed crochet. If you add beads, which method do you prefer? Threading the beads onto the yarn and slipping them across the stitch or placing them onto each stitch? In the design that Debbie had done for the trip, we did both. And the different patterns they create are beautiful. My preference would be threading beads onto the yarn, partly because this is the first technique I learned and it feels easy. You thread loads on, then you bring them up to the stitch as and when required for the slip stitch method, and the bead sits on the yarn across the stitch. It feels a smooth movement. As I found out to my detriment in the past, it doesn't work well on all yarns, especially something like a mohair where it just literally shreds it. When beads are individually placed on a stitch, it gives much more scope for pattern design because they can be placed closer together on rows above each other. Whereas with the slip stitch method, there needs to be a row in between to secure the stitch above the slip stitch. Hopefully I've explained that right. I have to say, I find placing a bead on a stitch, either using a crochet hook, a beading needle, or dental floss, quite laborious. I think because I'm a fast knitter, it feels like it's slowing me down just too much. It's interrupting my flow. I understand the reason for the two different methods and the different effects created by them. I'm just not sure I'm ever going to prefer the hooked in method. When I do it though, I prefer using a crochet hook. A very fine crochet hook. I think mine is a 0.6. Putting the bead onto the crochet hook, putting the stitch on, and then moving the bead down. I find that better than using dental floss or a beading needle. Maybe just because it's a kind of more rigid tool to use. How about you? If you add beads, which method do you prefer? And if you hook them in, what tools do you prefer to use? Last month, I was also reminded about the different knitting needles we use and which I prefer. We all know if we sat in a room full of knitters, there's going to be a variety of different types and makes of knitting needles being used. I was brought up as a youngster using straight needles, and when I first got back into knitting, I used my legacy knitting needle collection. I'm struggling to recall the first time I used circular needles. I think it probably was when I did a border on the Debbie Abrahams mystery blanket in 2011. But of course, that would only have been to get a long length of needle to put so many stitches on. I wouldn't have been using it to knit in the round. I did go to a Hazel Tyndall Fairisle workshop at Shetland Wool Week in 2012, where I must have used one. I just can't recall that transition of trying out circular knitting. Which do you prefer, straights or circulars? Have you always used the same, or have you too shifted your preferences over time? I recently found out just how much I've switched over to using circular needles. Even when I'm not knitting in the round, I use them for flat knitting as well. With my Italy trip pending and the thought of having a couple of summery knits, I dug out some Rowan yarn I bought years ago to knit a summer cardigan from one of the Rowan magazines. The only circular needles I had that were the right size to use were on my cashmere Entrelac knit, which I didn't fancy taking off the needles and then having to put all those delicate stitches back on again. I was impatient to wait for new needles to arrive. With my eagerness to get started on it, I began it on straight needles. Generally, when I'm knitting, my knit row is tighter than my purl row, and I think that's the case for quite a few of us. It seemed a lot more noticeable using the straight needles though. I'd only done a couple of rows when I dropped one of the needles on the floor, and that's when I instantly recalled one of the reasons why I don't like using long straight needles anymore. One of the many reasons. I also found they were knocking my arms. I wasn't able to spread out all the stitches in the fluid way they would sit on the cord of a circular. I couldn't contour the knitting around my body to check the sizing, and I needed a bigger project bag to accommodate the long needles, and so on and so on. The more I knitted, the more I was getting frustrated, but I kept persisting because I wanted this cardigan to take away with me. I'd probably done about a third of the back when I challenged myself as to how I was going to keep feeling if I carried on knitting all the other pieces with these straight needles. And what enjoyment was I actually getting from it? I gave myself a very good talking to for being impatient. I frogged it, I ordered some more circular needles, and I accepted that there was going to be no summery cardigan to take to Italy. I also made a start on one of the summer tee tops in my queue to take to Italy. Yeah, I realise that sometimes I have grand ideas on just how much knitting and crafting time I have. I managed 3 inches of the sleeve before I went away. That's parked for now, and maybe we'll go on the pile for a summer top in 2025. Does anyone else overextend their crafting time expectations? Something I've always wanted to be is a sock knitter. Firstly, the practicality of always having a portable project I can pick up and knit on the go, using up those odd ends of yarns from various other projects, as well as being able to make my own socks because I wear socks a lot. I've started doing Stephen West Rising Dawn pattern, which is designed for a variegated or speckled sock yarn with a slip stitch texture. I started on circulars doing magic loop. As much as I tried, having done magic loop on sleeves before, I found this too tiresome. guess what I did? I switched to short, double pointed. I've realised it's finding out what you prefer to use for each different type of project. Here I prefer straight needles for a knitting in the round project and circulars for a flat project. If you're a sock knitter, I'd love to hear about your experience knitting socks and whether you use Magic Loop or DPNs. I'm also interested in your preferred techniques. Do you knit toe up, cuff down? Do you do the afterthought heel? For some reason, toe up seems more sensible to me, I suppose. Yeah, I'm not quite sure why, it just that seems more logical to me. However, I'm doing cuff down. I'm clearly on the start of my sock knitting journey, and maybe I need to try out the different methods before I decide which one I prefer. I have to be honest though, at the moment, sock knitting is not singing to me as an enjoyable pastime, and it's nothing to do with the pattern. It's the working in such a small circle, and it seems to take so long. I'm on a 2.25 millimeter needle. I think that might be a size 1 US. But yeah, it's very fine, and it's just taking a long time to get anywhere with it. These two projects then, using the Rowan yarn for the cardigan and using hand-dyed sock yarn, and I'm also getting some Shetland yarn ready for a couple of projects, got me thinking about my stash. I started acquiring my stash in 2008, and it was predominantly Rowan yarns, because at the first retreat I was on, it was a Rowan sponsored retreat, so we were working all with Rowan yarns. And then I subsequently went on some Rowan workshops at their headquarters in Holmfirth. And back then they used to offer big discounts on the yarn at the end of the workshops. And from time to time, I'd also buy Rowan discounted yarn packs in the John Lewis New Year sale. And I also got a couple of packs at the Ali Pali knitting show many, many years ago. And with a subscription to Rowan magazines, my list of projects grew fast. Alongside this, I started Debbie Abraham's Mystery Blankets. And with a trip to Shetland Wool Week, my knowledge of Shetland wool grew too. And although I did a hand-dyed workshop on that trip, it was a couple of years before I really got into hand-dyed yarn. Which do I prefer? Different projects, different yarns. I lean more towards purchasing from small independent businesses now. I seek out 100% wool, and I use far less large commercial stuff. In fact, I can't even remember when I last bought any, but I do still have some to work through in my stash. 6 years ago, I did a stash spreadsheet, and I think now might be a good time to reevaluate my stash and see how my preferences have changed over time, considering what I've learned about knitting and also about different yarns. And it'll also give me a good idea to reacquaint myself with some of the projects that I've got lined up. I mentioned Italy then. I've had a week away at the Watermill in Pesara, Tuscany. This is owned by Lois and Bill Brecken. And if you're looking for a special retreat, either on knitting, painting, creative writing, or learning Italian, then this might be worth a look. It's been on my to-do list for many years, and it was wonderful to finally go. A well-oiled machine, Lois and Bill have thought of everything, and they totally spoil you. You literally want for nothing. There are trips out each day, amazing Italian food and wine. The Watermill is a wonderful place which they have restored over the years. And there's lots of different locations, both inside and outside of it, where you can sit and craft. There's a kitchen to make yourself a cuppa, have a biscuit, or have a glass of wine outside of the main meal times. We had a day trip to Lucca to wander around, which was great, and a city that I would love to go back to and explore more. My purchases were a linen dress in a factory outlet and a couple of card leather wallets also in a factory outlet, so I did pretty well. As I mentioned, Debbie Abrahams was our tutor, and we were a group of 11 knitters and one non-participating husband. Debbie designed an iPad and phone case, which was in Tuscan colours using Rowan cotton glacé, and that is a Rowan yarn that I absolutely love. It was one of the first Rowan yarns I ever used, and I just love how structured it is and the stitch definition that you get from it. The design that Debbie did incorporated a variety of different techniques. There was beading, both methods, slip stitches, intarsia, textures, scallops. I decided to make the iPad case larger so it would fit my laptop. I also wanted to add the word Tuscany to it, which is my little bit of extra creative flair. The front of it is heavily beaded and the back is plain stripes. So I made one stripe larger and I've Swiss darned Tuscany into it. I got the knitting finished literally at the show and tell at the end of the week, and I've sewn it up and I've done the Swiss darning since being home. I've yet to line it with fabric, but at least it's functional as it is. Regarding my three garments that are still outstanding, if you've been listening for a while, you know there was four of them and I popped them all in a hat and I drew out on the podcast what order I was going to do them in. The next up is the Islay jacket sleeves, and I've picked them up a couple of times the last few weeks and I've managed the odd row here and there, but nothing substantial. It's a pattern that requires concentration and I've not allocated the headspace or time to do that. I have decided, though, to frog the next one in the queue to be done. And that's not because I just want to get away with not having to do it. It's The Weekend Alight by Andrea Mowry. And it's going to be very hard to frog it because I have made so much of it. I've done the whole body and 2/3 of one of the sleeves. In my heart, though, I know this is the right thing to do. And the reason is this. You know when a pattern gets released and you want to knit it so it looks exactly the same on you as it does in the photograph, on the model, in the pattern. In reality, though, it's never going to happen. My shoulders might be wider, narrower, more rounded, more angular. My bust larger, smaller, I'm taller or shorter. You get the gist. We've all got different shapes. However, I think the top should have similar drape. It should hang in the same structured way. I'm not sure I'm explaining that very well. Hopefully you'll understand what I'm trying to get at. I don't like how this jumper looks on me though. And the reason for it is because in the past, and that's a key bit of information, in the past, I have preferred fitted tops, negative ease tops. Today, I don't wear fitted tops like I used to. Might change again one day, but for now, this jumper is just too tight and it doesn't feel right. And it doesn't resemble to me what it should look like in line with the photo on the pattern. Because I historically used to wear more fitted tops, I think I get a bit cautious about putting in positive ease. I'm always slightly concerned that I'm going to end up with a too baggy jumper that I'm not going to like, which is daft because that's what I like about the jumper as shown in the photo on the pattern. What do you prefer? Do you prefer positive or negative ease, or do you make a mix of both? I realise I tend to, as I say, be cautious, be a little bit conservative on when it says positive ease, when actually I should go full out with the recommendation on the pattern. And the recommendation for the Weekend Alight is 10 inches. I checked and I've done 7 inches, which of course straight away, regardless of whether my body shape is different, it's not got a chance of hanging or looking similar when I've left 3 inches of fabric out of the garment. I'm going to start this over again, and I'm going to be confident with putting the 10 inches of positive ease into it. You can see then I'm not trying to dodge doing this particular jumper. I'm starting it all over again and I will let you know how I get on with adding in those 3 extra inches of positive ease. The jigsaw puzzle challenge. Ooh, how did my dad and I get on? Well, Tuesday the 7th of May at 1400 was the day and the time. We both attempted to see how far in 3 hours we could get with a Gibson's 100-piece puzzle called Halfpenny Bridge, which was used in the 2023 UK National Jigsaw Puzzle Championship. 3 hours is the expected time for people in the elite section to complete it. Bear in mind, though, that in 2023, the winning time was 1 hour 52 minutes. What can I say other than how do you complete a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle in that time? If you do jigsaw puzzles, what's your preferred way for starting them? Do you get all the pieces out, put them right side up? Do you sift through trying to find all the edge pieces and make the border up first? Do you get them all out and put them all into colour piles? How do you do it, or does it change depending on the different type of jigsaw puzzle? Lots of different ways, no right or wrong way, of course, but what works best when you're trying to be speedy? I certainly didn't have a speedy strategy. I've got one of those desks that moves up and down, and I decided that standing was going to be the best, you know, it would keep me on my toes, I'd be agile. Yeah. I started off my preferred way, which is to find all the edge pieces and get the border made up. Although there was a couple of elusive pieces which I couldn't locate, and I decided that they would show up later. There's a lot of grey in this puzzle. You can see a picture of the completed puzzle on the show notes. The bridge is grey, the steps are grey, the pavement's grey, there's a grey wheelchair, there's a grey building, the clouds are grey, there's grey clothing, and so on. I thought, right, once I've done the border, I'm going to start doing the sky. So I picked out all the blue pieces. I just then hit a blank. They were so blue. Not much difference in them. I'd got one or two pieces that were fitting together, but not a lot. At this point, I started to get really aware of the clock, and I was almost feeling a little bit panicky, thinking, oh my goodness, how am I going to get this done? What do I tackle next? I then opted for working on the buildings, which were red and orange, and there was a couple of distinctive features on one of them. It took me ages to find the pieces, though. At 1 hour 52 minutes, the winning time from last year, I was lost for words. How? I had still so many pieces that were nowhere near getting put into the jigsaw puzzle. I also realised I was touching pieces repeatedly as I was searching for edge pieces or searching for a particular set of colours, and that's clearly not efficient. Let's just say at this stage, neither my dad or I will be entering the competition. At the 3 hour mark, we both had more pieces that were not in the puzzle than were. It was easier to count the pieces in the jigsaw puzzle and take them away from 1,000 rather than count all the pieces that still had to be put into the puzzle. I won, which my dad put down to my nimble fingers from crafting. I'm not so sure. It was a difficult puzzle. And I think we were both very conscious of this being a timed exercise. And we had a little feedback section on how we tackled it. We'd both started the same way with the border and then tried to find a colour group. Ultimately, though, we found it wasn't enjoyable doing it under that time pressure. Despite this, we have decided on a return rerun, with both of us looking at the way we approach the puzzle for a timed competition and what different ways there are and how we can be more strategic in the way we tackle it. The puzzle has been bought and we plan to do it in July. I'll let you know if we manage to get a little bit further with this puzzle than we did the first one. Dorset Buttons and wider news from the TJ Frog Pad. Towards the end of April, I ran a Dorset Button workshop for Uti, who runs Wild at Art, Creative Experiences in Scotland, which this year included the Sky Textiles experience that I was teaching on. And there are various drawing, painting and walking retreats in the Outer Hebrides, the Isle of Iona, and a small ship painting and wildlife cruise around some of the Inner Hebrides. And currently, UT is hosting a sacred geometry course, which started in Glasgow, featuring work by Charles Rennie Mackintosh, and they've now moved to Inverary in Argyll, where they're working both outside looking at nature and ancient buildings and also working in a studio with two artists. And I've been following it on social media and it looks absolutely fabulous, right up my street. Yeah, would love to do that. If you are interested in doing any of these types of holidays, do take a look at UT's website. There's a link in the show notes because provisional dates for 2025 are already up. Anyway, back to the Dorset Burton workshop. I ventured up to Portree. They were staying in a couple of different houses, and the one where I did the workshop, situated right on the shore side before you get into the main town. Beautiful, beautiful location, lovely house, and I set up in the dining room. We had a great time making beaded Dorset buttons, lots of chatter, very lively session, and I was treated to an excellent dinner with them afterwards. It's the second time I've done a workshop for UT, and it was lovely to be back with her again on Sky. I got home late in the evening, and the following day was the Woolly Good Gathering in Edinburgh, which meant that we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to set off. The Woolly Good Gathering at Summer Hall in Edinburgh, if you've not already heard, was a very special event. The team promoted from the start, when they first advertised it, their strong set of values and their beliefs around people, community and collaboration. And this shone through over the weekend. Summer Hall is a quirky building, having once been the University of Edinburgh's veterinary college. And the show was held over 3 floors of the building, which is also home to several artist studios, and there was exhibitions on, which are open to the public. There was also an outdoor courtyard with a pub and other eateries and a cafe inside. There was a fantastic community vibe about the place, with live music and lots of space to wander about and hang out with your yarn pals. For a couple of hours, I had a very small pop-up in the room where people were collecting their show Kickstarter goodies. And it was perfect. It gave me a great opportunity to meet new people and to connect with yarn friends I'd not seen for ages. A special shout out to Carol. Hi, Carol. You know who you are. Carol helped me out after my pop-up and just before my Dorset Burton workshop, looking after my suitcase and getting my water bottle filled up for me. The Dorset Burton workshop went very well. Everyone made a Dorset Burton bouquet brooch. We had a wonderful convivial atmosphere in the Dean's office. The sun was shining in, and it was just a great time sharing crafting stories and learning. Thank you very much for coming, everybody. It was lovely to have returning Dorset Burton makers, people who had been on previous workshops with me at other events, and to meet new people who wanted to learn the techniques. I grabbed a pizza outside afterwards with Hannah and Leslie, who'd been in my workshop. Thank you for your company. And then we made our way to the neighbourhood for the evening event, where we were entertained with song, music and storytelling by Charmaine Yarntings, followed by Yarn Bingo, which was all a lot of fun. All in all, it was an excellent day. The following morning, before we made our way home, I had time to go around the various marketplace venues. I spent the first hour in one room, and I think I moved, well, I don't know, just a handful of feet across the floor because I kept bumping into people I hadn't seen for ages, which was lovely. I made 2 purchases. First up was some sock yarn, which is the yarn that I'm currently using for the socks that I mentioned earlier. The hand-dyed yarn is the Librarian Sock Base from Lola of Third Vault Yarns. As a kid, I was a big book lover and I enjoyed my weekly trips to the library, stepping into the peaceful, calm environment with that all too familiar smell wafting from the pages of books and whiling away time lost in the next set of book treasures to be found on the many shelves. For years, I wanted to be a librarian. While I didn't quite fulfil that, I did work in education and learning centres, some of which had a library facility. And this wonderful multicoloured sock yarn was chosen because it also went with the yellow boots I had on at the show. Secondly, I bought issue 6 of Morrit magazine and I am going to dust off the crochet hooks. This independent crochet magazine is run by Alison of the Keep Calm and Carry Yarn podcast, who was also one of the organisers of the event. Spoiled for choice from all the patterns in the magazine, I've chosen a top which is called Moments of Joy by Jessica Kochar as a reminder of the joy that I had at the show. It's described as a spin on the classic log cabin pattern. And I love the geometric pattern and the use of five different colours. I'm going to be using my own TJ Frog Shorelines and Strata Dorset Down double knit for this. And as knitting is my natural default, my preference, I feel crocheting this is likely to challenge me. But who knows, I might surprise myself. Which do you prefer, knitting or crochet? The dates for next year's Woolly Good Gathering were announced at the slightly earlier time of the 4th and 5th of April. Since this announcement, though, I see that in the middle of May, Summer Hall was put up for sale. I'm eagerly watching to see what happens, as it seems to be a very active cultural centre in Edinburgh and home to many, many events, which would be a huge loss if this does not continue. So let's watch this space on that one. I will also be in Shetland for a couple of weeks at the end of September to include Shetland Wool Week, which I'm very much looking forward to. The Shetland Wool Week hat was announced late April, and if you've not seen it, it's called the Arlesborough Tory, and the patrons are the Dools farming family. I've chosen my colours, all naturals, now to get it on those circular knitting needles. My attention is now focused towards the end of the year, first on the Yorkshire Yarn Festival, the 8th to the 10th of November, and on a festive holiday offering that I'm working on, as well as the completion and launch of the Never Ending book. I've had to push back the virtual workshops to September with various other commitments that are happening over the next 2 or 3 months. And I do also know that over the summer holiday time period, people tend to do less crafting and less workshops and things because there are other priorities. The virtual workshops will now be on sale on the website from early July. Patreon and Ko-fi are up and running, and many thanks if you have already offered your patronage in this way to support the podcast and my work. I've added an exclusive addition to the Tadpole tier, which is a spin-off from the podcast. For each podcast episode, there will be an ad-free, exclusive video on Patreon taken from one area that I've chatted about in the podcast. This spin-off video is something I've been thinking about for a long time. Wasn't sure when and how I might do it, but this seems the perfect opportunity and place to host it. The video might be about a sky location. It might be talking about and making something from materials that I've used from somebody who I've interviewed. It might be exploring a place relevant to a creative I've chatted to on the podcast. It'll be something that's relevant to the content of each episode, and it will go up onto Patreon a day after the podcast episode is released. For this month, I've produced a video about the Sky Bridge, a drive and a walk across the bridge to Sky with me. I'm still learning about all the Patreon software, so please bear with me during these early phases. And I'm sure as I do more and more videos, they will also evolve over time. Websites, as you know, are a never-ending piece of work, and mine yet again is needing an upgrade and a refresh. I apologise to those of you who've left comments on the podcast page and they've not appeared. I'm also conscious some of the audios are not available currently. I've had an enormous amount of spam for this page, despite all the plugins that we have, and it's taking a lot of work behind the scenes, deleting and blocking. We are working on getting the podcast available on more podcast platforms and also a refresh of the website. I've talked about exploring other creative avenues, and an opportunity presented itself to me back in April to stretch my creative thinking. I want to learn more about Skye and where I live, the Gaelic culture and heritage, and my community and land around me. I've always had a slight conflict going on with my work being here in Skye and being rooted in Dorset and Dorset Buttons. And I know in the early days when I was doing craft fairs up here, from time to time, people would say, "Have you made this Dorset Button thing up?" Back in April then, I went to Uist in the Outer Hebrides for a couple of days on a course, which was run by Tobor and Dukos, who are based here at the Gaelic College down the road from me. They hold a vast amount of audio material, which is recordings from people dating back many years, illustrating Scotland's cultural heritage, such as song, poetry, talking about traditional skills, the folklore, customs, beliefs. The audio material available on this website comes from three major collections: School of Scottish Studies at the University of Edinburgh, the National Trust for Scotland's Canna Collection, and BBC Radio Nagal. The course was aimed at creative people, and it was designed to showcase the material they hold, to learn more about the resource and why and how the material was collected, and what value it is to us today, and ultimately to encourage research and inspire our creative practice. The tutors were themselves practitioners who have experience of working with the material. Snippets of tracks were played, research shared, community projects explored. We investigated how the richness of this narrative they hold enables us to learn about the past while also being able to carry it forward. I hope to come back to this at some stage and share more of it with you. Suffice to say, I wrote pages and pages of notes on the course and chatted to artists and various people working in different creative fields, sharing ideas and thoughts about this wonderful collection of history that exists and how we can use it to inspire our creative work. I feel very privileged to have managed to secure a place on this course, to go to it, and to have been in the company of people that I was in. And while it was very much focused on Uist and the Outer Hebrides, it's really given me the opportunity to learn how to explore the archives, how to look up information that's relevant to my area here on Skye. And I'm very much looking forward to spending some time researching this and exploring some of the creative ideas that were prompted over those couple of days that I was away. Skye Focus, the local lowdown. The third and final part of my series about how to get to the Isle of Skye. We're a true island in that we're surrounded by water, but not in the sense of only being able to get here by boat, as we have a bridge. The Skye Bridge, which runs from the Kyle of Lochouse over onto Skye, replaced what was a short ferry route between the Kyle of Lochouse onto the mainland at Kyleakin, which used to be the gateway to Skye. The Skye Bridge is, in my opinion, a lovely feature and a great way to arrive on Skye. There's the main concrete arch, which I always love when it comes into view as we're winding our way home along the A87. It links Skye to the island of Aileachan, once home to the lighthouse keepers and later to Gavin Maxwell, the author of Ring of Bright Water. Then the next part of the bridge runs flatter from there to Kyle of Lochouse. In all, the bridge is just over a mile long. It comes with a tainted background, though, with much greed and tragedy, which is often overlooked and may well be totally unknown to the one-time visitor to Skye. Building for the Skye Bridge began in 1992 and opened in 1995 as a toll bridge with a charge both ways. Instead of the UK government paying for the bridge, it was privately funded by an American company and apparently ended up being the most expensive toll bridge in Europe. I saw a film about it not long after I moved here called The Rising of the Bridge, and there was also a programme about it on BBC a few years ago, The Battle of the Skye Bridge. For a decade, there was many people campaigning to get the tolls removed, with a group called SCAT, Skye and Kyle Against Tolls, set up fighting for this cause. At the start, people turned up refusing to pay the tolls. They were then charged and reported to the Procurator Fiscal, who himself ended up having a nervous breakdown from the stress of dealing with it all. The film I watched had first-hand footage from people who had been part of the original campaign. It felt like there was much sadness along the way, with families torn apart, people ending up with criminal convictions, and ironically, when they refused to pay their toll payment and had to appear in court, which was on the mainland, they had to go over the bridge to get there, and so they were incurring yet another fine. Some people, apparently, are still fighting today to get convictions overturned. In December 2004, the Scottish Government purchased it and the toll was lifted. And in 2008, they made all Scottish bridges toll-free. It is reported by the time the toll was lifted, the amount raised from tolls far exceeded the bridge build cost. If you search on the internet or YouTube, you'll find snippets of video footage about it. If you've travelled over the Sky Bridge or you do in the future, then spare a thought for the story behind it and the people who fought to get the tolls removed. The bridge now brings us other problems. With the world becoming a far smaller place and our access and knowledge of where to travel to at our fingertips, sky tourism is higher than ever before, and the bridge means we're very accessible. The problem is, we're still rural, we're still fundamentally an island, and we don't have the infrastructure for the amount of people visiting. For the other Scottish islands, the ferries mean that there's a capacity that's reached in terms of the amount of tourists who can arrive. We can't limit numbers, and I see more and more frustrated tourist comments on the internet who've arrived on Skye and they get angry because they can't get accommodation, they get turned away from restaurants because there's no bookings available, they can't get parked at beauty spots, and then they end up giving places a one star on TripAdvisor because there was no room for them. I'm not sure what the answer is, but the bridge is both a blessing and a curse. That ends my little series in the three different ways in which you can arrive on Skye. The community-owned Glenelg to Kyrea ferry, the Calmac ferry from Mallaig to Armidale, or the Skye Bridge. Which way have or will you come to Skye? Did you or will you arrive one way and go back a different way? What do you or might you prefer? Ferry or bridge? Answers on a postcard. I'd love to hear your thoughts. That's it for this episode. Take care, and in the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch, either drop me a line at tanya@tjfrog.co.uk or via the contact page on the website, or on Facebook and Instagram as TJ Frog Skye, and you'll find me on Patreon and Ko-fi as TJ Frog. The music is by Ron Paintant and licensed from Melody Lutes and called One Frog for a Prince. Bye for now, until next time.